Welcome to Good Medicine is Cheaper Medicine. I am Shelley Wrench, along with Dr. Nash Gabriel with the Gabriel Cancer Center. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, you've had a couple of exciting days the past couple of days. I think the listeners would be interested in knowing where you've been and what you've been up to.
Oh, I visited the swamp.
Did you drain it?
Huh?
Did you drain it?
No, Shelley, I tell you what, when you fly over Washington, D.C., it is really swampland. That's easier to drain physically than the metaphorical swamp that Trump talks about.
So the environmentalists would have an easier job than...
And I had a unique experience yesterday with the government, the Food and Drug Administration. They asked me to go there and testify on behalf of a drug company about a drug that I have done research on. Actually, I ended up treating more patients with it than anybody else in the world. So they wanted to see the FDA, the way, maybe this is what I should explain to the public, is how is the decision made for a drug to be approved and not approved by the FDA?
I agree.
Of course, a drug has to be approved by the FDA to be available on the market.
Well, to be available, explain to me, like herbal medicines, or are people just, you know, put together the combinations?
Those are not drugs, though. Those, the herbal medicines and the food supplements and the alternative medicine things...
They're not regulated.
No, they're not.
So this is regulating drugs that actually make a difference in your life.
Yes. But you know what's funny? I mean, first of all, I worked at the halls of the FDA. Remember, to you and I... The Food and Drug Administration, there's food and there's a drug. Actually, the food part is very, very big. And they have all these exhibits. Jars of grain, of wheat and corn and whatever. Jars of pasta. Yes. So the FDA is a big...
Do they have to do like a taste testing on this?
Oh my gosh, yes, they do.
I wouldn't want to be the guinea pig.
They do testing. I remember they also test... They do check on toys, they do, but I didn't investigate. I just looked at the kind of the exhibits, like at GCC, at our cancer center, what's our exhibits? It's golf paraphernalia, right?
Right, right.
They've got golf balls, history of clubs and so on. There, their exhibits are all kinds of drugs and foods and food materials and whatever that they have been tested over the generations, subjected to the testing, subjected to the inspections, and then ended up being in the market. But we will ignore that part. I was more interested in looking at the medicine side, and that's what we need to talk to about to the public. How does a drug get approved? And so this drug, we've been working with this drug company, for how many years? About 7-8 years, and we were investigating a pill that you take it twice a week to treat a form of cancer called multiple myeloma, and but also we investigated that pill for many other cancers, and I liked it because it is a unique mechanism of action. For the public to understand what that means, well. Let's say the first antibiotic discovered was sulfur. So there was the triple sulfur, and there was the sulfur whatever.
And it was by accident, right?
Yeah, of course. And then there was penicillin. So when penicillin was discovered, right, then people start making penicillin-like drugs, like amoxicillin, like penicillin V, penicillin K, penicillin G. And these are the, you can call it the copycat drugs.
Or the Me Too movement.
The Me Too movement. Actually, there is a lady, she used to be the editor for the New England Journal of Medicine, Marcia DeAngelis, I think her name was, is. She wrote a book about, I think the title was The Me Too Drug. I read the book, small mm-hmm. drug and mm-hmm. small book. And she described how she was critical of the process of the Me Too drug. So, like, when penicillin was invented, somebody came with penicillin V, penicillin G, penicillin K. Then somebody came with the brilliant idea of cephalosporins. and all of a sudden there was Rosefin, there was Keflex, and there is about 15, 20, but they all work in the same mechanism, just little modifications. So every company comes with a tiny, tiny little modification to get a patent to make more money.
Right.
The process works. So when cephalosporins were discovered, I was excited. Keflex, when it was invented, I was excited. Then when they came with Rosefin, it's another Keflex, it's IV. And then there was Fortaz. Yeah, it's another cephalosporin. Yeah, you don't get excited about those, but, you know, at least give you options. I'd give you competition that drug companies are competing with each other.
Right, to drive down the price. It helps to drive down the price.
To help down the price, exactly. That's why we like that. And then there's the Cipro. Ciprofloxacillin, which is I think it's RNA gyrase inhibitor. Again, excited. That was in 1986, 87 when it was, came in the market. It was exciting. A new class of drugs. Then came Levaquin, which is the same class. All right, that's another me too drug. This drug we will work on for the last 7 years. It's a brand new class of anti-myeloma drugs. So for multiple myeloma, we have alkylating agents, which have been around for a zillion of years. We have proteasome inhibitors, and there's a 4 or 5 of those, but the flagship was Velcade. And then people start making something similar, right? There is the IMiDs, the initial one, thalidomide, and then there is now two more, Revlimid and Pomalyst.
Pomalyst, yeah.
And now we have another class called CD, anti-CD38, only one drug, called Darzalex, and there is one cooking in the kitchen now, which will be available on the market sometime maybe early 2020, and that's it. So when people get exposed to all these, and if all these classes don't work, you're kind of stuck.
So this is where this drug comes in, is for when everything else fails.
And so we did the clinical trials. It's about got 20, 30 centers worldwide. To do the myeloma, and it did work. Lot of side effects. And
So that's why they asked you to go, is to talk about this.
So basically, the trial was basically a single arm phase 2 trial. And this is how it works. The drug company did the clinical trial, we helped them, and they spent a few million dollars on that. I know it's very expensive. They collected the information, followed up the patients, did the analysis, and believe me, every single word I say requires a group of consultants who get paid heavily. Just to make the public know what these companies go through and the amount of money they spend. So they're doing the study, and this is about 7-8 years. Initially, 8 years ago, these husband and wife, he's a doctor and she's a PhD, very smart people, they came with the idea. The lady actually had a PhD from Israel, and she thought that there is this pathway. It is an enzyme or a pump that pumps out toxins from inside the nucleus. If you keep those toxins inside the nucleus, the cell will die. Cancer cells have a lot of those toxins, but they leak. So when there's DNA and they're inside the nucleus of the cell, when the DNA is replicated, a lot of these toxins and poisons are produced. But they exit by this carrier, it's almost like a golf cart, get it out from the cell, from the nucleus into the cytoplasm, and the cell survived and goes inside again and bring more. She and her group invented a molecule to block that.
To keep it in there so it just dies upon itself.
Yes, so make the cell commit suicide. In Latin, we call it apoptosis. And we started the experiment, and we experiment with it. And I was at Gabriel Cancer Center on about 70 plus patients. These were patients who really, they're all cancer patients that we didn't have anything to offer them. And we saw some awesome, awesome responses. But the most benefit was, of course, this drug company, their supply of money to fund people like me, to fund the special consultants, to fund the software they use, you name it. There's a limited supply of money. So what they do, we treated so many patients, and they said, okay, what do you think? would be the best one disease to target that we go to the FDA to identify a disease based on what do you see. And it was agreed that probably multiple myeloma would be the one because there were patients with multiple myeloma who did respond. More importantly, there is this unmet need. Myeloma patients, actually I'm repeating myself what I said yesterday on the podium at the FDA. Myeloma patients, when I was doing my training, myeloma patients lived average 27 months. That was 30 years ago. Now they live average 60 plus months.
That's because I can't even imagine with all the years that I've been at GCC, our myeloma patients do extremely well.
Mm-hmm. They stick around.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah.
And in fact, there were some myeloma patients who came there to testify. Some of them had been around for, there's one guy, 18 years. But we have to realize also, a lot of that is because of our success in coming up with the new drugs, our success in support care. Just think about it, Shelley. There is this drug Zometa.
Yeah, which is now generic, yeah.
There was, before that, there was Aridia. You have no idea. I don't think the public know how much difference these two drugs have made. And there's, of course, the Xgeva, which you see the commercials on TV now.
The shot instead of
IV, right.
And I took the IV. I had the Aridia.
You had the Aridia.
Yeah.
But recently you had the Prolia anyway.
Yeah.
These drugs have made a big, big difference in the life of patients with myeloma. Why? Because multiple myeloma patients, by the nature of the disease, the cancer cells in the bone marrow secrete chemicals that melt the bone. They dissolve the bone material. So what happens? The bones start shrinking or it breaks. So when the bones shrink, imagine the bones of your back shrinking and they start collapsing. You start getting curvature in your back.
Kyphosis,
yep. Very good. And you lose height. And when you get too much kyphosis, your lung capacity gets affected. And your rib cage flips inside. You start getting your...
A lot of pain, shortness of breath.
Yes, yeah. You name it. And when I was doing my training in both in Scotland and in Missouri, multiple myeloma patients, most of the time they came to the office on a stretcher. We were told, when you examine patients, we do percussion.
Right.
We were told, don't do that, because their bones are so fragile, you can break them. And they were right.
Well, I remember the one myeloma patient that came from Detroit. She was in a body cast, in a wheelchair.
Yes.
And 2 weeks later, she was with a cane, or walker, and then 2 weeks after that, a cane, and now she's wonderful.
That was 9 years ago.
Yeah.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
And she's still doing well. She's still in complete remission. But she relapsed, and then she went to remission again. So these domains, and broken bones was a real problem. And when people break their bones, you have to have surgery. Now, I don't remember, I mean, knock on wood, when was the last time I saw a patient with multiple myeloma that broke the bone?
I can't even remember.
So back to the process. So a decision was made 6-7 years ago that we will take a bunch of patients, multiple myeloma, who have been treated with all the drugs that we know, and now kind of...
I think it's important that everyone knows that clinical trials are not just only for when there's nothing else, though. In this case, it was a clinical trial when everything else that's known has failed. But that's not all the clinical trials we do.
Excellent point. Excellent point. That's only for this trial. You're right. And the reason we chose this scenario was because we had drugs that work. We didn't know if this experimental drug would work or not. So we
don't want to put it in front of the standard of care.
That works.
Right.
Now, if we know that this drug works, and then subsequent trials, we will start to use it in addition to or as a substitution
to standard of care.
To the drugs that work, right, in different scenarios. Very, very complex process, well regulated, well organized process. So That was the patient population selected. Apparently, at that time, they went to the FDA, the company executives and their experts. They went to the FDA and they said to the FDA, you know, guys, this is what we design. The FDA said, no, you have to compare it to something else. And they said, compare it to what?
Yeah, there's nothing else out there in that space.
They said, compare it to placebo.
Ooh.
And the guys said, I don't think so. Or how about compare it to best support care? They said, guys, we don't want to do that.
No, I agree.
We want to try this on every single patient. They said, okay, go and do it. Well, that disagreement haunted them yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yes. The FDA experts, there were two ladies, both oncologists, sharp ladies. They don't see patients. That's their job. And I think it was time for them to show some vendetta. Because the first thing it was a fascinating thing. I mean, we started at 12 o'clock and we finished at 5. And initial presentation was, and there was about 40, 50 people in that room. The initial presentation was by the drug company. There were three of them. Each one of them presented what's the drug, how it works, what all the trials done. And then it was the FDA presented the information. The FDA, they're experts. They already have the information. And I knew from the presentation that the drug is doomed, that there is vendetta. Because of the statement they made, you didn't run it by us. And the lady from the drug company, she said, yes, we did. But you wanted us to compare it to placebo. We don't want to do that. Our investigators, I wouldn't have done that.
Right. You wouldn't have chosen to do that clinical trial.
Absolutely.
That would be
not
compromising the patient.
Yeah. I mean, my gosh, yes. But they wanted that. Because, again, these are the academics. That's the people who go work for the FDA. They're the people who are the professors. They read the books. They read the literature. They read the slides. And people like me, I sit beside patients, and I listen to them, and I feel their pain.
Yeah, you have boots on the ground.
I have boots on the ground. These guys, they don't. There is a disconnect between. I just give you an example, Shelley. If someday somebody bring you a nice rabbit, cooked, awesome, beautiful, and suppose you like rabbit,
cooked, like for me to eat.
The producer likes rabbits, and we'll give you the rabbit, right?
Give it to him.
and he will eat it. But imagine if you show him how shooting a rabbit and killing it, he will have totally different perspective about eating the rabbit. I bet you, when you go and see a lamb, when you see it how it's slaughtered, probably you will not be as excited about eating lamb. Not everybody, of course. The point I'm making is people like us who are facing cancer patients every single minute, we hear about their pain, we hear about their frustration, we hear about their fear, we hear about their family, we hear about their job frustration, we hear about you name it. That collective information is so useful, and the FDA knew that. So they asked me to go. I was the only community oncologist there. They asked me to say, they said, come on, give us your perspective. What do you think? But I knew.
And they only gave you 3 minutes. They didn't know that three minutes.
Actually, I didn't need even 3 minutes because to me it was very slam dunk. And I told them, don't do this. Don't play this game. You need to do this and this and this and. But at that time I knew, they have already made the decision. Because all the big shots from the FDA were there, the director and the two oncology ladies. So they presented their case, and even I went to the CEO of the company after the presentation. He said, we knew that it's going to be tough. So the FDA, they don't make the decision on their own. They have these experts, oncologists. And usually,
that's the ODAC.
No, the FDA have their own staff.
Okay.
And usually, these are oncologists who just finished their schooling.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Okay.
It's kind of funny how the system works. They finish their schooling and they go work with the FDA. Can we talk about the swamp again? Because this is swampy.
It's starting to get really, really thick in here.
Once they work at the FDA, they have very powerful positions, although they are just fresh graduates. They have the power of the billions of dollars by simply saying, no, we will not approve this drug. That's very powerful. After 3-4 years, when they have learned all the inside information, all the outside information, and established connections, guess what? Drug companies attract them because now they have contacts, connections, and knowledge of the process.
Oh, my goodness.
Drug companies hire them for 10 times what they make. And it goes on. Or some of them go...
Isn't that kind of some kind of insider information that they're actually seeing the inside the process?
Well, yes.
I mean, I know why pharma... It makes sense why pharma wouldn't hire them.
It's legal, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's legal, though. In fact, Trump, I think, has introduced a rule that anybody who works in his cabinet or in the White House cannot work for any foreign company for at least 2 years after they leave, because there were people, believe it or not, who work in the White House. Next day they quit. China would hire them. These guys, yes, we are a democracy. I know it's twisted.
Yeah,
I know it's almost dishonest. I know it's unpatriotic, but these are the facts, and that's why Trump doesn't like it. And
well, surprised he only limits it to 2 years. I would think it should be 20 years.
No, it has to be fair, because after 2 years, you will lose your contacts, you will lose a lot of information, and those parties will not be as interested. But anyway, the FDA is the same way. Once I was giving a talk at the Senate building in Washington, D.C., and one of the speakers after me was a congressman. His name is... Steve Collins, yes, and he's from Buffalo, New York, I think. And we were discussing the challenges we're facing, that sometimes the FDA experts are really not up to par. And he said, guys, let me tell you how it works. He said, I just came out from the meeting with one of the leaders in the FDA. I said, how can we help? And she told him, if you want to help, allow us raise the pay scale, because there's a limit to how much government employees can get paid. Do you know that, right?
A limit to how much government employees get paid?
Right.
Okay.
There's a cap.
It
cannot exceed the $425,000, which is what the president makes.
What's reported?
No. What they make legally. Okay.
Yeah.
The bribes and all that, you don't count those.
Okay.
She asked if it would be, because I think maximum is 175, 200, whatever it is. She asked if they would be allowed to hire experts and pay them, have a pay scale as high as the President of the United States, 450, I think. And he looked at me and he said, I don't think you will ever work for the government worth $175,000 a year. But he said, somebody like you who's experienced 20, 30 years, you do a lot of research, you would be a big asset for the FDA, you'll be fair. And I said, absolutely. 450, 455, I might think about it, but not 175. So the lady complained and she said, guys, we're hiring these college graduates or medical school graduates. From school, immediately they come to work for the FDA. And then after 3-4 years, they get all the information, all the contacts, and bang, they leave. They hire a new set. These people, they come, they are green behind the ears, you call it?
No, it smells pretty swampy.
So that's what happened to this company. Their feelings were hurt. Because normally, when you design a trial for a new drug, you really have to get the blessing of the Holy Father, the FDA. They didn't do that, and to be honest with you, Shelley, I would have done the same. I would have told the FDA, guys, you are misguided. Our patients are not a toy. Yes, there is no treatment for them, but try something. And I don't think it's... I mean, you know me, I have issues with the placebo thing.
Yeah, I do too, major. But just because, you know, this is more of an economic program, What happens to that company now that they've spent all these millions of dollars?
For lack of better words, I say screwed.
Okay.
It's not the company, the investors. There are people who invested in this company for the last 8-9 years. Their money is gone. Because there was a vote, and believe it or not, the vote was 5-8, meaning five people adamantly felt that, yes, we need this drug. And I stood up, I said, guys, when patients fail all the drugs we have now, I don't have anything. True, the drug has side effects, fatigue and all that. But I said, that's a decision to be made by the patient and by the physician. A patient who come and say, listen, this is the end of the road. I want to try something. And I tell them, you'll get so tired. Patient will say, that's okay, I'll try it. They try it. If life is miserable, they will say, you know, doc, I tried. I'm done. Or they try it, fatigue is not bad, continue, all of a sudden, there is a new drug came to the market. Why? Who are these people that they feel so powerful and so empowered to buy just a signature? No.
Yeah.
Now, these are the panel. They are advisors, 13 of them. This is what I had some issues that not all of them were docs. 3 or 4 were physicians. The rest were PhDs, statisticians, whatever. And they actually don't have patient contact, patient experience, the way we do, feelings about patients, patients feeling about us. But anyway, so if these people have said yes, approve the drug, that would still be only a recommendation. Still, the ladies who don't like this company will still have the veto power.
Gotcha.
But it will be difficult for them to muster that when they have a whole panel saying you have to approve the drug. I am hoping that the process will be better. Dr. Gottlieb, the new commissioner, he's a solid guy. I'm just hoping it was a great, great experience. It was 2 days worth spending in D.C.
In as well.
And it was a first-hand experience, really behind the closed doors of what happens and the dirt that there is there.
Well, this is great. I want to remind our listeners that all of our previous episodes are available on our website at GabrielCancerCenter.com. Thank you very much for representing oncology at the FDA.
Yeah, thank you.